dare I say, hasn't had so many moments this year. No. Last year, you used to see on Fridays and Saturdays the odd front end washout. It looks so much smoother.
Oh, Mark Hennessy's crashed!
Oh, my goodness me! The commentary curse!
Hello, and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 600. That's a big 600. Nothing really special for this show, other than the fact that you get to listen to me and Jim talk about MotoGP from COTA. Jim, how's it going, man?
Yeah, it's going great, man. Had a great time in COTA. Met a lot of people. Had fun. Survived the pseudo-tornado thing that happened. So I figured I deserve a t-shirt. It says, I survived Ike in 2008, and I survived the Texas Twister in 2019.
Well, more to get to that. But first, Jim, a little bit of a Motopod tradition. Well, you shouldn't put the cap in the glass. That never works that well, but...
So what is it you're drinking, my friend?
So today, Skyler's opinions that will be making an appearance later on in the show to much avail is brought to you by Dragon's Milk from New Holland Brewing. It's a bourbon barrel aged stout. So I love my dark, chewy beer, so I'm pretty sure this is going to be right up my alley.
There you go, man. Sounds good.
It is good. I wonder how strong it is. 11%. Might get loopy by the end of the show. We'll see how things go. All right. We'll just maybe be real slow on that one. All right. And before we get going, we always have to thank our donators. And this month we have Nick Saban, James DiPietro, Alan Fleming, Keith Kovac, Scott Sunder, and Joshua Tuttle. Thank you so much for donating to the show. Remember, folks, if you want to be like those lovely people there, you can just head to our website, that's motopodcast.com. On the left-hand side, you'll see the donate buttons. One is for a one-time donation, the other is for a subscription. You can donate as much or as little as you'd like. Every bit helps, and we put it right back into the show. Get us to the tracks, get us interviews, you know the drill. If PayPal is not your thing, just head over to Patreon. It's patreon.com/motopod. All right, Jim. Well, we don't have any errata or listener feedback this week, so why don't we jump right into the news?
Sure. The first thing up is that the bumpy COTA surface came in for some criticism from the MotoGP riders. Austin knows that the problem exists. They've ground the track the year before, and they ground it again before this year, over the crest of turn 10 as you head to the very far end of the racetrack for turn 11. It is an interesting thing. From what I understand of it, I am not a geologist, so don't hold me to this, but the surface or the material that makes up the surface there in Texas is a combination of clay and a rock that's a talc-like rock. So it creates like a very slippery surface. If you ever put like baby powder on an inner tube and try to put it inside your motorcycle tire, it'll slide around real super easy. So this clay is moving over top of this talc, if you will, and it's creating all the bumps, and there were quite a few incidents with it. The worst parts are turn two as you come down the hill and into the S's. Then there's another really bad section there at turn nine, and then the back straightaway heading to turn 12 is really bad. There was a great Twitter from MotoGP. It was Marquez in qualifying, and his feet just come off the pegs because the thing was just banging around so bad. Aleix Espargaró. Oh, who rides the KTM? Pole. Yeah, I get him backwards every time. But Pole had such a bad tank slapper that it broke the steering stops on his triple tree.
Jeez, really?
Yeah, it broke both of them off. It sheared both of them off, which is crazy.
That's insane, yeah.
Now, they, like I said, COTA tried to regrind the surface here, but it's definitely not working. The riders want something done before they come back again to the turns, turn two, turn nine, and the back straightaway. Where turn 10 was, where it was really bad, COTA actually resurfaced that, and the riders are okay with that resurfacing, so that'll work. But I was reading in Cycle World, I think, an article, when they knew about this problem, that the surface could be moving around, and they actually took it and they dug out 8 feet deep and put a compacting gravel into it and then put the surface down on top of that 8 feet of compacted gravel. So this is moving around, and they tried, and this may never, ever be solved. I just hope that we can come to some system where we don't lose this race in America. That's the biggest part for me.
Yeah, because it's tough, because they also lost a huge subsidy this year by the government. They lost, you know, the $20 million. And what is it to put on an F1 show? What's the fee? About $30 million just to get them to come to town?
I think it's something close to that, yeah. And I know they're not making $30 million from ticket sales for Formula One. So.
Yeah, and so that's, you know, that they I think at one point were trying to resurface quite a bit of the track. This is going to put a huge stop to that, which is a bit of a bummer because, you know, Indy suffered from a very similar thing with a lot of the bumps on the track too. You know, any place where you're getting a lot of high downforce cars can cause this too. But I have a buddy. He lives about an hour and a half north of the track there. And when they were building, he said the one thing they got to be careful because these hills be moving. And I was like, really? He goes, yeah, the dirt around here, there's people's houses that, you know, start separating on the foundation. It's even at that level. So I'm not surprised that they're having issues, especially with the track, with amazingly in Texas has a lot of undulations and
it's not flat, that's for sure. Yeah,
you know, hopefully they can get this resolved. Like you said, we don't want to lose the race, you know, in America, because it's definitely not going back to Laguna. If you want to take a second, I can actually find out some cool information about that. So they I think her name is Gil. Oh, I can't remember her name. There's another podcast. Jim, let's do another podcast. Can you believe
Shame
it?
Shame on you. You cheating on me? I hate
and,
you.
It's actually, it's really good. It's called Dinner with Racers. They have a cool little spin how they sit down with, you know, motorcycle racers. They sit down with car racers, people who are around car racing track owners. So they, Gil, she's the, I'm killing me that I can't remember her full name, but anyway, she runs the show over there, right? And she was explaining how they were losing money when they brought MotoGP to town every single time, and just to get the show to come to the track, it was $3 million, and they couldn't even make that back over the weekend. And as we know, Laguna Seca is actually owned by the county. The county doesn't pump any money into the track. It's all done by private funding. So that's why Mazda and Yamaha did so much to kind of bring it back up to snuff. And they'd have to dump more money every time. They would make a little bit of money off the events, FIM, and be like, okay, we need to make these improvements to the track. And all the money was gone. So they didn't lose the MotoGP race. They actually asked, they were like, they said, do you want us to come back? They said, no, we don't. We can't afford you guys. Have a nice time. Yeah, and I thought that was interesting because a lot of people thought, oh, they lost them. I can't believe it. You guys lost GP. It's like, they didn't lose them. They actually just said, nope, we're not doing it anymore. We can't make any money. Sorry. Huh, okay. So that was quite big. I thought it was much like the latter in the conversation where they lost it because they didn't have a big enough paddock to have all three series there or what have you. So that was interesting. So like you said, hopefully Coda can get some money, or they can figure out a solution to get these bumps out of the track. Because, like you said, it's not just the fact that they're bumpy. They're in hazardous places on the track, which can lead to some very, as we saw, Jake Gagne had a, you know, kind of a gnarly crash, and we saw a couple crashes in the race. You don't want to be leaned over in a turn and catch a bump. That's not a fun time.
Yeah, it's not. It doesn't work well. Suspension doesn't work on the lean angle plane. It's made for vertically up and down. That's for sure.
Yes, sir. Well, some other people were having some issues out there this weekend that weren't on the they were on the track, but it wasn't because of the track, and that was Honda. HRC ran into some problems, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. You got to think back, when's like the last time you saw a Honda have a problem in a race, let alone three problems in two weekends? Now, Marquez started this off with a chain that jumped off the sprocket in Argentina. So thought was it was kind of like one of those sort of one-off deals, not a whole lot going on there. But the same thing happened to his teammate Jorge Lorenzo in qualifying at COTA. Now, Jorge was coming out of the final turn. He was up on the curb, and those curbs are pretty sharp-edged because they're there for the race cars and Formula One. And the bike was definitely bouncing as it went across it, and he tossed a chain. Again, it's one of those things where people were thinking like, hey, it's just one of those oddities of the time that is just, it's bouncing and whatnot. Now, Simon Crafar had an interesting comment. He said that it was a Twitter, he said that it was interesting. It looked as though that Honda had actually figured out the limit of flex to a carbon fiber swing arm, which he may be right about. The carbon fiber is laid up in patterns, and if you cross those patterns across each other, it creates a stronger bond. And the problem is that it's really stiff in one direction and doesn't have any give in the other direction. So they kind of mix and match that pattern so that you can get some flex and some feel out of it. And maybe Honda has taken that just one step too far, and we have now got this problem where they're tossing chains off of it. So, and the next time that happened was Lorenzo's bike stopped going into turn 12, and it was not a chain. So HRC says that that was actually an electrical problem. That's sort of like, I guess, the Formula One catch-all, right? We had an electronic problem. Now, there is a theory that was expanded upon by Kevin Schwantz at the racetrack that says HRC is having problems with their gearbox on the bumpy circuit. Now, we know Honda invented the seamless shift gearbox, and it's quite possible that they've either tried to make it faster by making parts lighter or changing the actuation and how that it engages or disengages, and they may have potentially got something wrong in that gearbox. It's interesting that it was only on Jorge's bike, and it was not in Marquez's bike, although we don't know if it would have existed in Mark's bike, because, you know, Mark had his problems. The interesting thing to me on this is that they said it was an electrical issue, and before anybody gets like, oh, well, that's the catch-all, it really could have been, because you're bumping a bike around. Weird things tend to happen. Here in the Midwest, we have the race at Indianapolis at Raceway Park, IRP, and it's a Weir Cycle Jam. Happens in June, and it's a big race. And that track is so bumpy and so sharp. When we went there back in, you know, 99, every time we went, we would actually bounce the bike around so bad, the electrical connector from the main harness running to the, you know, the speedometer, tachometer, warning lights would work its way free and come apart, and the bike would quit. And it was, despite the fact that we would take zip ties and wrap them around that connector.
I was just about to ask, what about zip ties?
Well, the first time there were no zip ties. Okay, so that, all right, stupidity. Learn your lesson the hard way, right? Second time, it had two zip ties on it, and somehow it had enough where there was some motion going on where the zip ties were able to slide on that plastic and pop off. So it's not impossible that it was an electrical problem of that sort, that, you know, the bumps or whatever caused the problem. But this, I think, is something to keep an eye on. Do we now have a kink in the Honda reliability armor? So something to watch for in the races as we go on.
Very much so. You know, something else to watch for is the Anthony West watch. I just have to be scrolling through the news updates and saw that he had placed a third in a race in the Brazilian Superbike Championship.
I saw that feed too, and I think he's actually leading the points in that Brazilian Superbike Series. So Anthony may be yet a Superbike champion, which would be what, a couple countries? Because wasn't he a Australian Superbike champion?
I believe so. I know that's a quick Wikipedia lookup, but I don't really know. Well, maybe I would say, oh, I can edit back in the show. I'm not going to. I'm going to edit this thing and go to bed tonight. And then in the final bit of news, Nikki Hayden's number was retired officially at COTA on Hayden Hill. It was a great celebration. Everybody came out and took a nice picture there. They had a huge number 69 put on the hill there at COTA. It was very nice to see. And his whole family, close friends, and the entire paddock and then some were there. So very nice. And it was good to see that was just getting done. All right, so let's get on to some qualifying. That starts at Moto 3. And there's Q1. Okay, cool. That's good. Let's get on to Q2, because there's, what, like 30, 40 riders, Jim? So why don't we just jump right into Q2? And you got to see that, so lead us off.
Yep. So Saturday morning was very interesting. The rain that had been predicted came, and it was biblical. It only lasted.
That's where I wanted to stop, because you were boots on the ground. Yeah. I saw pictures when I got up in the morning. And I kind of came back in from my yard work, and people were showing pictures of the paddock, and the AMA guys were like getting flooded out of the paddock.
Yep.
And then I realized that everything, because Mother Nature was having a day on Saturday. The World Superbike race had snow, they had to cancel, and then a lightning storm came through. Yep. What was going on, man? How crazy was it?
It was super crazy. Try to compress this a little bit. We were starting out to go back to the track on Saturday morning, got woken right. up with rain just pounding against the hotel window. I had looked at the COTA app, and they said, hey, we're not letting anybody in until 9 o'clock.
Oh, so they weren't even letting people in. Okay.
No, they weren't letting because there was such a great lightning storm happening that they wouldn't let anybody in until that storm had passed, which was supposed to be like at 9 o'clock, roughly. So we're downstairs, we're eating some breakfast, and another flash comes up on the COTA app on the phone. Hey, due to another storm that's approaching and the danger of lightning, we're not opening up the gates until 10:30. Ooh. Like, whoa, man. Okay, well, what are we going to do? Well, that was only information that was there was that. Eventually, we wound up going to the track. It was bright sunshine. It was beautiful. And as we got near the track, you drive in that tower, that 400-foot tower, you can see from miles away. Yeah. As we came into the track at about 10 o'clock, roughly, you could not see the top of the tower. It was covered in clouds. No, the ceiling was that low. And I'm like, wow. Oh, well, that's why we're not racing right now. The helicopter can't fly.
Yeah.
Medical copter can't fly. So we hung out. We partied with a bunch of people in the parking lot and whatnot. So finally, it became like 10:15. We said, hey, let's go get in line and get in. As soon as we got in, we walked up. We looked at a couple of vendor stands. And basically, here came the COTA people again saying, hey, there's another storm coming. You need to go back to your cars and take shelter.
No way.
Yeah, that was what happened.
That's not a small track. I've been on like the turn 10 side. It takes like a good 30-40 minutes to get across right. that thing.
Exactly. Oh. So the next thing that happened was like the app said, hey, you know, go back to your car, go to the main grandstand, or go to the tunnel number 2. That's your safest places. And yeah. I'm like, okay, this is getting out of hand. And you looked off to where the airport was. You can see the airport from the track. And yeah. all of a sudden, it turned black. And I mean Jeez. Black, like you couldn't see the airport control tower black. You couldn't see the lights of the airport black.
Wow.
And I'm like, I looked at my buddy Joe and I said, hey, we are not going to make it back to that car in time for this when this hits. So we took some shelter underneath the soccer stands that are there. There's actually a soccer field at the track. So we were there. Man, all of a sudden the wind came up, the temperature dropped by about 20 degrees, and it started raining. And it was that completely horizontal rain coming at you. The next thing that happened was in the midst of this downpour, the COTA people are yelling at us to get out from underneath this metal grandstand because it's not a permanent structure. It's not anchored to the ground. And there was the threats of high wind. So luckily there was a concrete block building and kind of we hid with about another 100 people. We hid behind this concrete block building while the storm came through. It lasted all of maybe 10 minutes and then it just turned bright sunshine. The rains tapered off and then the winds came on for that day and it was just extremely high winds. It was blowing basically like 20 miles an hour constantly, and it had gusts up to like 35 or 40 miles an hour. So that's how Saturday kind of pans out for qualifying. It was pretty wild, very much so.
Oh, that sounds insane. I'm kind of glad I missed that part of it, not the race, but I'll definitely skip the storm. All right, so getting back to the Moto3 qualifying, like you were saying there.
So all the practice, all the morning practice was canceled for all classes. We basically jumped right into Moto3 qualifying. It was a wet track. Darren Binder basically went out in that first qualifying session. He rode the whole session, finished on top, graduated to Q1. I thought he would be the man to actually beat because he knew kind of where the puddles were. He knew where the grip was. Thought he would run pretty good in it. He eventually wound up being fifth. But Niccolo Antonelli pulled and won out to go to the top. He was followed by Fernandez, Rodrigo, Masaya, Binder, Canet, then Tatsuki Suzuki, McPhee, and then Lopez were your top 9 coming out of that qualifying session. So it was one of those things where it was all about rider control, about how you control the throttle and what you were doing. And basically it was luck. The track was drying continuously as it went on. So last man standing kind of won, and that was Anton Niccolelli. Antonelli.
Yeah, you know, speaking of Antonelli, it seems that he's quietly had a bit of a resurgence. This was a guy several years ago, you know, he was the hot commodity, and then he just had bad year after bad year with the KTM IO team. And many people wondering, like, if this was his ceiling, if Moto3 and he's out. And then he's kind of, you know, he was running at the front when we get to the race, you know, a little bit later on. But he hasn't been making a lot of mistakes. That's what was killing him. He was crashing a lot. And it seems like he's kind of got it all screwed back together and got his head right. It's just good to see him on pole. But it's really just kind of great to see a bit of a comeback story there.
Yeah, yeah, it really was. It was nice to see that. I thought it was also, it was rather interesting. We had a pretty good mix between KTM and Honda in the top nine bikes. The speed deficit of the KTMs wasn't as significant, I thought, in qualifying at least. So,
absolutely. Cool. Well, let's, oh, there's that. I got to say, absolutely. That's what I'm talking about. Just jump right back into stuff. And that's the word I go to. All right. Well, anyway, let's get on to Moto2 qualifying, because this one had some similarities to what we've had before, and we've also had a bit of a mix here.
Yep, we did. By this time, when you had Moto2 qualifying, the track had become completely dry. Everybody was on slicks from the very beginning. Of note, Jorge Martin and Bo Benschneider came out of that session, first qualifying session, to get into the second qualifying session. In that session, Alex Marquez was at the front. Him and Lowe's were definitely fast right through there. Luthi had a shot at it as well. Binder looked really good on the KTM. He was in with a shout at the pole until the very end, when Marcel Schroeder threw down the time that was necessary to make it go, and he sat on pole. Alex Marquez was still tried at the very end. He tried to nip Schroeder, but he couldn't do it. He was second. Lowe's was third. Luthi was then fourth. Binder finished in fifth on the KTM, and you had Jorge Navarro sixth on a speed up. Then Pacini, Martini, and Corsi were there. So you had
I just wanted to say, let's just pause a second, because Matteo Pacini came out of retirement and he's filling in for Fernandez and puts it seventh. Hasn't turned a single lap on the bike. And remember, these are Triumphs. These are the new bigger bikes, completely different. New, you know, team he hasn't been, hops on, seventh place? Man, this guy shouldn't have left.
Yeah, he shouldn't have. But it was interesting to see that you at least had, to me, that it was interesting that Binder on the KTM was fifth. Martin was eighth on the KTM. So things were kind of looking up, I think, at KTM and Moto2. I think they're finding their way a little bit. The interesting thing is, I learned over the weekend, was that they are still racing on the same profile tires that they used last year. I've heard that when they get to Jerez, they will have a bigger, wider profile tire to use on these bikes, and I'm wondering if that's going to have that kind of shakeup like we've seen in MotoGP when Michelin changed the fronts.
I think it has to. I think it'll be a big mix up.
Yeah, I think it's going to mix something up until these guys get back on top of that again. I don't know if Dunlap is still going to provide that bigger tire at Jerez and also provide, say, the tire they're on now, or if they've decided to hold that off until everybody can do some testing on it at the end of this year. I don't know where that is. The one last thing I'll say of a qualifying, Remy Gardner had a vicious crash coming over the hill at turn 10.
Yes, he did.
He looked like, from the replays, that he, well, from what I read and what I saw, he tried going over the top. It got a little bit of a tank slapper from the bumps that are there, because there's one sort of close to the apex on the curbing. He hit that. A gust of wind then caught it and flicked him basically over the top, and he just slammed into the ground. It was a nasty crash, and it was a good thing to see that Remy was actually okay after that, considering the injuries that he has obtained in his career.
Yeah, no, it's kind of been his downfall, really. It's been his injuries, and the fact that he was able to escape that, it's good to hear.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now the big boys. We're going to get into a little bit of MotoGP qualifying, and we kind of probably were going to assume who was going to grab pole, but going basically any place but first, it was anybody's guess at this point.
Yeah, it sure was. So because of all the rain and no practice sessions on Saturday morning, it left us with Jorge Lorenzo, Petrucci, and Dovizioso all inside the first qualifying session. And shock of all shocks, at the very end of that session, Lorenzo put down a cracking lap on that Honda to get in to the second qualifying session. And Petrucci did his teammate no favors whatsoever by taking the second spot to go in. So Dovizioso was going to have his worst starting spot at a track that he doesn't excel at in...
Yeah, 13th.
He was going to finish. He was going to start 13th, which he hadn't been 13th since like 2007 or something like that, I think I read. So it was looking pretty ominous for Dovizioso. Hey, he was going to be near the back, and we're going to have to see how he was going to do with that hole shot device that the Gigi Deligna has on the Ducatis. But in qualifying session two, I think that everybody saw what was going to happen, and that was the fact that Marquez was going to go to pole. He did. The interesting thing was he did that pole time on his first run, and there was a lot of speculation that, you know, Jorge had gone out in front of him. Now, Mark did back off of that, or back away from, and create a gap between himself and Lorenzo, but on that backstretch, Marquez just caught him like Jorge had literally dropped anchor and slid by with a fairly aggressive move into turn 12 to be in front of Jorge. Now, I don't know what was really going on there, if there was gamesmanship, if there was actually they were going to try to tow Marquez around, but I think it was more the fact that Mark was just putting his stamp of authority on the session and sending sort of a mental mind message to Lorenzo that, hey, buddy, this is my team and my bike, and you're not going to steal my thunder in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, Marquez does not need a tow around Cota. This is a guy who's won at that track since 2013. It's the worst graphic that they can put up all weekend. Who are our past winners? Just move that to the side. You don't need to let us know every single year, although it led into, you know, what was going to happen this year. But the Hondas obviously were strong at this track with Kyle Crutchlow finishing there in third. But the old man Rossi bringing it up in second place. The Yamaha at that. What a good showing.
It was a great showing by Rossi. He looked good from the first part of practice. Rossi looked like he had some pace. I didn't quite expect him to. I knew he was going to be fast. I expected him to be in the top three. I had actually picked Marquez, Crutchlow, Rossi for the front row, but missed it with Rossi being second and Crutchlow being third. Mm-hmm. Miller was the fastest of the Ducatis, and he was the only one who basically ran a good set of laps consistently like Marquez had. Rossi had the good laps, but his variation from lap to lap was greater than Marquez. So Marquez was maybe varying by like maybe a tenth, where Rossi was varying by like maybe two and a half tenths. So race pace was definitely Marquez's. Miller definitely had race pace. And then Espargaró was fifth on the KTM, which I think is their best ever dry qualifying, which was really good. You had Vinales on the other Yamaha. So Yamaha having a good weekend. And then you had Rins starting seventh on the Suzuki. Rins looked good on that Suzuki. And if you're standing, you know, everybody talks about how great handling the Suzuki is. You can tell that visually if you're standing in the S's at Cota. If you're standing anywhere from turn two, three, four, five, six, you can see how much distance that the Suzuki makes up. And in practice, we were able to stand there and see Dovizioso go through, who basically was gaining time on the straights. But whatever he gained in the straights, he would lose with the inability to be able to turn the Ducati where the Suzuki could turn. And Rins would just close the gap up immediately in that twisty section there with the S's. It was really neat to watch. And you could actually see the slower turns when you get over to like 12, 13, 14, 15. You could see Rins actually back off the throttle, and he could just change his arc in his line and turn the gas back on, where Dovizioso is committed to a line, whatever that line is, it's basically staying there, and where Marquez can only turn the bike if he's on the throttle. So it was really neat to see the differing contrast in how the Suzuki worked versus how the other bikes worked.
Now let's get into the Moto 3 race. And Jim, to me, the first thing that kind of crossed my mind as the riders were lining up, even after qualifying, is Fanati going to feature in this race? Now, of course, we know, emotions aside, as far as, you know, me and you, I think, are on the same page of you know, Fanati being here. We've talked to that. We don't need to get on that. But he is a, like, the Kenan Sofoglu of Moto3 this year. You could be him. You're probably going to do okay. But then he really hasn't been that guy. He hasn't been the force that he's been. And I don't know if it's the team, it's the bike, or if it's him. But you sit in the beginning of this race, like, is he going to show up? I felt like he never really did. And it's been the same thing for the first couple opening rounds.
I agree with you, because I was thinking the whole time, where's Fanati? Because he never was playing into anything. He was never at the top of the time sheets. He was never near the front of qualifying.
Never on camera.
Yeah, he was just not there. It was shocking. It really was. I mean, like I said, the guy has talent. The guy is quick. He was really quick on Moto3 bikes. And you're going, where's the disconnect? I don't know if what he has done in his career and what has happened recently is weighing on his mind. Like, hey, I need to be that little extra careful so I'm not riding free like I used to.
You know what I wonder, and I'll pass this on to you because you've raced. Do you think his Moto3 skill has been compromised by the adjustments he made when he went to Moto2?
I would say no, because it's, to me, it's like riding a bicycle. You never forget. I can only make this comparison, and it's probably a really weak one, but at times I was racing a 4-stroke 600 single dirt track, but also racing a 250 2-stroke at the same time, which requires you to ride each bike in a very different way with different horsepower, different technique, and different gearing, different lines. And I could jump back and forth between the two and not make a mistake. So I don't think, you know, Fanati's a better racer than I ever was or could ever think to have been. If I could do it, I'm pretty sure, you know, Fanati can do it. I believe it's more to do with his history that's causing the problem.
Fair enough. All right. On to the next person who I was concerned about, and then it happened, was Ken Anshu. He's kind of had a bit of a toss back to reality. I'm not expecting to do what he did at the end of the year in Valencia last year, where he came out and did the win, little mixed conditions and all of that. He's got to learn his craft in Moto3 competitions. Everybody's that good. But he was back. I think he crashed out of, what, 20th place again, and kind of did it on his own.
Yep.
Obviously, he's got a long year ahead of him, but what I wanted to focus on is, because I knew you were going to be on the show and I wanted to talk to you about, in a racer's mind, when you have success, is it harder to bounce back when you fail after success? Because if you fail before success, it's a learning curve. But if you get up there and you win a race and you then have 2-3 of these, like the next year comes up, you're like, okay, cool, I got this, I can compete, and you just get slammed those first three races. How big of an impact is it on his confidence going forward from this point?
Okay, for me, if it was me in that situation, I don't think my confidence after three races would be my problem. I would still look back at my Valencia and say, I can do this. What I think is happening is he has allowed the weight of expectation of what everybody else thinks of him play mind games with him. I think he needs, and I think IO knows this, and I think they will, you know, basically get him back on the right track. He needs to be sheltered a little bit from the social media, from the media in general, and he needs to just focus on what he's supposed to do, which is learning his craft and setting up a motorcycle and making it work. And that is the important part that he needs to stay with and stay focused on. So I think that's what's wrong, is it's the weight of the expectation that he has had placed upon him.
I mean, it makes sense. I mean, it's a huge expectation. You're riding in the Red Bull team and you're coming up and you set the bar really, really high after last year. And, of course, how old is Ken Anshu? What is he, like, you know, 15? Oh,
he's 15. I don't think he's 16 yet.
When I was 15, trying to ask to be on a world level, on a world stage with cameras, I would crawl into a hole and that'd be the end of that.
Oh. The one thing I want to add to this, and to me, I don't know the circumstances, so if someone knows, please let me know, or write into motopod@motopodcast.com and tell me. When he fell, he rode back into the pits, and he never reemerged. Now, I don't know if he had broken the motorcycle to a point where they could not fix it, but at 15 years old, he needs to get all the track time he can possibly get at that level. Even if he was going to be lapped by the guys out front, you get offline a little bit, you let him go by and tuck back in. So you can kind of get an idea of where do these guys break and how do these guys ride together and how do they ride in the pack. So that to me was a little disappointing that he didn't get back out. Now again, if he had a problem with the motorcycle that the team could not fix or that motorcycle was unsafe in any way, then my statement is not correct. But
It could have been a bit of that. Having dealt with a rider myself on a team that was 15, 16 years old, it's also a lot for them to take in emotionally. Sometimes they gotta go to the trailer and go pout real quick, get that out of their system. That's fine. It may also be a rule or maybe one of those unwritten rules that if you don't want to be that person in the back causing problems. I don't know, man. There's multiple things. I get what you're saying. Get the test time while you can on the track while you can. But more than likely, the bike was, maybe they didn't know what was going on with it. Maybe the bike didn't make it back for a while. And by the time it came back, they'd have like, okay, we got to check the tires. We got to do these checks. And like after our checks, we were only going to get maybe 5-6 laps of any good information. It's not worth it. Who knows? But anyway, enough of Ken Onchu. I want to talk about Darren Binder, because Darren Binder, this kid, sorry, Derek, I threw out a That was just for you, Derek. But the front end pushes that this guy is able to save and consistently do, he needs to be on a bigger bike. I understand, he's Moto 3, but I want to see this guy race against his brother. There's some serious talent there. And he blew up his tires by the end of this race. And we saw that because he was pushing really, really hard. But he is one of those guys that is just fun to watch, no matter where he's on the track.
Yeah, it was a good ride by him until he had the tire problems going into it. I agree with you. I think he's done with Moto 3. I think he needs to get onto a Moto 2 bike. And I think you would see him much closer to the front. I think his size and his riding style would be beneficial to that, would benefit from having a bigger motorcycle, especially the Triumph.
Yes, I agree. And obviously none of these guys are really huge, but the confidence to just throw it in there, you need that in Moto 2, and he's definitely going to carry that up there. Because there was, I can't remember what lap it was, remember he lost the front end and pumped it about 4 times in the corner, but never let off the gas. He just kept it on and wrapped it around. I don't know how he didn't crash.
He's been studying the Mark Marquez School of Front End Slides. Looks like he graduated, if you ask me.
Right? So we get to the halfway through quarters point. There was no point in taking notes on this race for what rider was in what position, because it's typical Moto 3. They're swapping 4, 5, 6 riders for 20 positions at a lap. And once again, qualifying wasn't always what it says.
At the time, that was probably true for they raced 17 laps. So probably the first 7 to 8 laps was that way. But then Suzuki got out front. And then things got really... Then things got really calm, because Suzuki seemed to have the situation well in hand.
Yes, he did. And when he got out there, maybe that's what kind of led to a bit of his issue, was that he was out there, had it well in hand, and obviously he has never been in that position, at least as far as I can remember, in Moto 3, and then ends up getting it, a little too hot into a corner, probably on the brakes, lost the front end. But there was something that was funny. I watched these races in reverse, right? I did GP, then Moto 2, Moto 3. There was a commentator, the commentators, they made a joke that if Suzuki, and that's Tatsuki Suzuki. If he wins, that'll be the first win for Suzuki since 2016 with Vinales. And it's like, ha 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 ha. Oh, if they knew the power of their words. Ooh, in about 2 hours. But then, you know, we saw that by that time, after Suzuki went down, we saw that Bender had blew his tires. And then we got to see Fanati on camera finally. But unfortunately, that's because him and Cornfile went down together. Fanati was out in front of him. He hit that vicious bump. What was that? I think it's 14, the one where they're doing the long, like the three right-handers in a row. Because they come to 12 is in the back straight, 13, right?
13, 14, 15 is right in front of me where from our seats at the track. And 16 is the long circular part with the four apexes that go around. Because that's 16, 17, and 18. They have three turns designated in that area, but the fast guys string it all together as one complete corner.
And that's where he hit that bump, and then unfortunately caught, you know, Cornfield nowhere to go, right by him, smacking him. Suzuki at the point, but the guy of the year so far, Joao Masia. This guy was nowhere. He was down at 18th at one point. All of a sudden he's up in fourth.
I was thinking how that happened, because only being able to see a small section of the track, it's like, how did that happen? But yeah, he suddenly just showed up there.
Jim, I'll tell you this. I watched it on TV, and I don't know how.
Well, I don't feel so bad then.
He just appeared. No, he's like the magician. He might get a new name. Masia the Magician.
I like that.
We're going to coin it here on Motopod. If he starts putting magician on back of the leathers, we're going to get 10 cents every race. I'm telling you right now.
Nice.
It's not going to happen. But we had a little bit of a throwback. Yeah. There's this guy, Aaron Canet, got out there, and he had the best thing. He got to the front exactly when he needed to. Got the smallest of gaps, but what it allowed everybody else to do, and there's that 11% kicking in, by the way, it allowed everybody to start fighting amongst each other, and Eric Canet gets away from the pack.
He got away from it and won the race. Masia came in second. Then you had Minho, Rodrigo, Antonelli, Arbolino, Fernandez, Lopez, Vietti, and then Dennis Foggia for the top 10. The interesting fact to me is it was KTM, yes. KTM, KTM, yes. all on the podium.
Swept.
Like, whoa. On a track that you would think the Honda with the horsepower would absolutely dominate, it was the sweet handling KTMs on the bumpy surface that made it to the front. Because all the good Honda riders were well down the list. McPhee was 14th. I expected it better out of him. Lopez was 8th on the Honda.
Dude, Marcus Ramirez wasn't anywhere in this race. Here's a guy we've come to expect on the whole Leopard Racing team. Him and Della Porta slipped back. He was showing strong in the beginning, but he slipped way back. I mean, these guys finished 9 seconds off the lead, back there on the Hondas. That's a bit of a surprise with those guys. That's not only a Honda, but it's a really strong Honda team.
Yeah, to me, it was one of these races where it just seemed like the entire field was just jumbled up. I want to say that everybody's rider's number was a lottery ball, and this just happened to be the order in which they came out at the end. It was one of these weird, like, the people you thought were going to be in the front weren't in the front. The people who weren't in the front were in the front, and it went around. But, you know, all props to Canet. I think, and he even said this in the interviews afterwards and on the racetrack, he used his brain more than he's ever probably used his brain in a motorcycle race. And I don't know if it's because of the team, because he's on a one-bike team with Max Biaggi in there mentoring him. And I don't know if Max has just maybe some magic wand that he's able to temper Canet a little bit and help him along, which if it is, that is absolutely great for Canet. But there, you know, at this point, looking into the championship and who's there, it is seriously anybody's championship. I don't think we've got enough data to say that Canet's going to be the guy who's going to be right there, or it's going to be Masia or something like that. I think we're going to have to wait until we've got about another 3 rounds into the championship for us to try to go, these are the guys that are going to be fighting for that title.
Yeah, I think what Aaron Canet picked up the best from Max Biaggi is how to grow a mustache, you know, the pencil thin lip. Okay. That's probably what he picked up. And there, honestly, you know, it makes the speed, you know, you just aerodynamics, Jim. Yeah. That's how it works. I don't know if you know this, and mustache makes you at least 3/10 faster. I mean, you know, more.
Sweet.
More
didn't know that off the grill.
Yeah, no, there you go. Like you said, so we got Joao Masia and Aaron Canet tied at 45 points apiece on top of the Moto3 Championship. Lorenzo Della Porta is sitting there in third. He is tied with Nicolò Antonelli, a bit of a throwback name there, top of the championship in fourth. Kaito Toba is in fifth, followed by Tony Abellino, Gabriel Barrigo, Marcus Ramirez, Andrea Mio, and Darren Binder, finishing out the top 10. All right, now, we finished up Moto3. We had a great race there. Moto2 was coming up, and the sun was shining. It was a nice day out there. Marcel Schroeder sitting on pole yet again. Could he turn this into a win? It was yet to be seen. So we get off to the beginning of the race, and there was a little bit of contact going to turn one, but unfortunately we lost our American rider, Joe Roberts.
That's the 11% talking right there.
I'm telling you, it is a straight concentration. I have not taken another sip because I got to make it for another 15 minutes at least. But Joe Roberts went down with Xavi Virhey and our favorite, DJ Antonio, all kind of come together. It was a bit of a couple of bikes going to a small place. And unfortunately, I think it was... DJ Antonio got hung up on Robert's handlebars and they all kind of went skittling there in the first corner.
Yeah, it was really close. The one bike had got real close to the fence and, you know, was kind of in that bouncy mode and it wasn't quite sure if it was going to make it over that or not, but luckily it was there. And the best part was everybody stood up and walked away from it. And, you know, sometimes that's going to happen at these kind of races. That first turn is a tricky turn because you are going uphill and it is much steeper than what you see on TV. Television flattens everything out, but it really is steep. And the real tricky part about it is that you have to make a choice. You either have to, in my opinion, you either have to finish all of your braking while going up the hill, because then it flattens off and then you've got to turn to the apex. Well, you can't ask your front tire to brake, turn, and be lightened because you've gone over the crest of something all at the same time. So you have to find that compromise, and it could have been that these guys just left it a little bit too late.
That's a good point. I didn't even think about that, where you may have collisions because of the different strategies going up to that turn. Like you said, it doesn't do any justice on TV. It is a tough, tough corner, and it's a hairpin after a long straight, which eventually turns right back downhill. It opens up. A bit sketchy, actually. So we get in the first lap, and unfortunately, our championship leader went down right there at a turn 10. He ran into the back of, I think, Oliveira. He ran into the back of him. Baldessari goes down. The bike skittles.
That was scary.
Yes, it was.
That was scary on the onboard. Mm-hmm. From the onboards, that was scary because I was like, wham, boom. And it was just over in a heartbeat. There was no chance at saving it. It just was, boom, done. And I think he ran into, you said it, I forgot it, Martin. Okay. Mm-hmm. Was Martin? Yes. Okay. Just kind of lost that there. But I think Martin had lost the front because I think that happened when they went over the crest at turn 10.
He had a bobble. That's what slowed him up.
Yeah. Yeah. He had definitely, I think he had lost the front and he needed to get off the throttle to catch the front again because, you know, letting off the throttle was going to weight the front back in again. He was able to catch it. And Baldessari was not able to recognize that that was happening because that's a blind crest. That's the best place to watch motorcycles at COTA is to stand at turn 10 and watch them come over the crest.
I did it last year.
Because that is blind and it is full commitment to be fast.
Yes.
So if you want to see who's got the biggest kahunas or attachments, stand there and see who's going fast. That's where you're going to figure it out. But that's a racing incident. That was just pure bad luck.
Yeah, that's what happens when you don't qualify at the front of the field. You know, you get stuck in the middle, and that's the kind of stuff that can happen, unfortunately.
Exactly. Yep. That's, again, you know, he was another one of those guys who was a victim of not having that early morning practice session to maybe right the bike a little bit better than what he had it at when he tried to qualify.
Yep. Brad Binder dropped out after the first couple laps of the clutch issue. Then we got to the nice little... go ahead.
No, when Binder rode by, it had to have been a gearbox problem of some kind because you could hear the bike kind of struggling and slipping, and then it sounded like he just couldn't find another gear or the gearbox was stuck in gear. I didn't know it was actually a clutch problem, but when he went by, it sounded like it was just stuck in gear. Like, you just couldn't make the transmission work.
Yeah, makes sense. Then we got to our first battle that involved Alex Marquez.
Yeah.
Not the first time that's going to happen. With Tom Luthi. That was a nice little battle they had there. Luthi stalked him for a while, and then he kind of got in front of Marquez. And you're thinking, okay, Marquez is going to fight. And then Luthi just kind of pulled the plug, and it's pretty much the last we saw of Tom Luthi at that point.
Yeah, Luthi rode a very smart race. He sat back. I don't know if he, I think a lot of people, not again, the weather played a part in this, didn't have a lot of data on how all the tires were going to work for the whole distance. And I think Luthi saw the pace that they were running at. They were making a little bit of a gap to the guys that were running, you know, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. And I think Luthi was just rode with his head and said, okay, fine, we'll stay right here. We're doing what we need to do. We're getting away from everybody. And then I think Marquez's tires started to go away a little bit. He wasn't getting the drive he needed off of some of the corners. And I think his front was also starting to go because he was not pushing into some of the corners as hard. So Luthi just kind of skated by, no problem. And then Luthi just put down the laps, consistently lap after lap after lap, to come home the winner.
Marcel Schroeter has to be sick of getting beat up. This guy has taken the biggest beating over the first three races I've seen of any Moto2 rider, even going back to our Max Earder days, because he's been up front. He's been leading the race, been on the podium, and just gets smacked into that hit between Marquez and Schroeter when they came out of turn 12 and they kind of did that cut back to make a lineup back for the right-hander. Both of them feed off the pegs after that. I'm surprised both of them made it out. I thought for sure Schroeder should have gone down because he hit him with the front tire into the rear tire, but he saved that thing just because I guess the momentum was going that way and it helped him keep balance. I don't know, but he's got to be getting tired.
That was the one where everybody in the stands went whoa, because you know that happened in our line of sight, and that part was pretty wild. And he saved it. It was really good. I think they kind of got lucky because they kind of hit, went apart, and then they kind of came together and righted themselves like two gyroscopes would and then went on. But it was really intense there for a few moments.
And then we saw, unfortunately, we lost Bezzecchi. He's having a real tough go for his rookie year. Eco Lecuona, who was the best KTM at the moment in the race, he had a nasty high side where he came and smacked his head. And then came Pacini. This guy started making his way to the front. And then he had probably the best pass of the race where he slipped under two bikes. I think it was in turn 14. It's because they come back to the... So 12 is left, right? So I think it's 14 when they do like the double apex there.
It's 14.
Yep. And he came back under two bikes to get back up there. I'm thinking, man, Pacini, why did you leave the series? He said he retired. So there's a bit of a conflict, right? Because on one hand, it's you hear the announcer say in the beginning of the weekend or beginning of the race, he's like, oh, he couldn't find a ride. No one wanted him. And then it's he decided to retire. Well, which one came first?
I couldn't find a ride, so I decided to retire.
Sounds like that to me. But regardless.
That's how I see it.
The guy come right out of retirement, and it looked like he had missed a beat. And I hope...
No, he did not.
I hope he gets to stick around for a little bit longer. I missed that guy in the series. The guy is amazing. But amazing, though. Navarro on the brakes. Woo! Jim.
I will say this. The speed-up appears to be well set up for him. He has found a... Again, we shouldn't be too surprised that the speed-up is showing good. Quartararo won a race on it. And now Navarro is showing us that bike has improved yet again. Their braking stability seemed, at least at COTA to my eye, better than the Kalex.
Yep. Oh, it was on TV. It was significant. He was closing down 3 to 4 bike lengths into each corner, and the trail braking was the amazing part. It looked like he could wash the front out, and it was planted, just absolutely planted. It was amazing to watch, really.
If you have confidence in the front, you can do amazing things on the bike. But you have to have the confidence that when you roll off that center edge into that corner with the brakes still on, that tire is going to do what you want it to do. And a lot of that is just how you as a rider approach that corner and how much you brake hard into the corner, which flattens the contact patch of the tire out. But then as you start to lean over or let off the brakes and you take pressure off, that tire tends to try to inflate itself back to that original shape. And it could be just that the fact that Dunlops are really that good at it. That was the one thing for me that was so hard to change my riding style on, was getting used to how a Pirelli squatted and then how it rebounded back as you rolled into the corner. It was, it's a very different feel than a Dunlop. And, you know, part of it could be that he's just mastered that feel, or he has the chassis set up exactly the way he needs it for that. It was, like I said, it was interesting to watch him gain that much distance on the brakes.
Absolutely. So we get to the point at the end here, Tom Luthy and Marshall Schwarzer take a 1-2 for the Dynavolt Intact GP team. Jorge Navarro getting, I think it's his first Moto2 podium in third. Mattia Piccini, who probably if he qualified a little better, might have actually been up on the podium, finishing in fourth. Alex Marquez in fifth. Luca Marini in sixth. Sam Lowes in seventh. Corsi in eighth. Enea Bastianini in ninth. And Andrea Locatelli finishing out the top 10. So Moto2 was a great race. Moto3 was a great race. Moto2 was a great race. And we get to MotoGP. Now, of course, you know, oh, we should maybe go through the championship here.
Just real quick.
Real quick. Before,
so let's look at this.
Yeah, let's jump to the championship real quick, because the guy who sat and watched the entire race is still leading it, Jim. Lorenzo Baldassare got lucky this weekend that he was able to crash and come out 3 points ahead of Marshall Schwarzer for the championship lead. Tom Luthy there in third, Remy Gardner in fourth, Alex Marquez in fifth, ahead of Marini, Navarro, Bastianini, Lowes, and Brad Binder rounding out the top 10. Okay.
Yeah, so let's go to MotoGP.
Yeah, because MotoGP, we were concerned. We want a good race. We really, really do. And Marquez, we're like, okay, maybe he doesn't get the whole shot. We could be okay. And Marquez got the whole shot, and you're thinking, oh, man, is this going to be over already? And then, like, oh boy, this is not what we want. But, yeah, we kind of expected this. So let's focus on other things. For in the first go, Dovizioso had a great start.
Oh my God, that was like the most electrifying start I've seen anybody make in a long time. Gigi Delinea's little invention, or copying the hole shot device that they use in motocross, works on that Ducati, because that was a wicked hole shot.
Yes, it was.
He was. But people got caught again for motion at the lights. Vinales got caught for it. And
Mir.
Oh gosh, who else? Miller.
No, not Miller.
Not Miller. Mir.
Yeah, well,
and Mir got caught for
it. Yeah, so they both got caught.
If you look at that, I don't know how they're able to detect that they've moved before those lights, because they showed the replay of Mir's, and that was absolutely like right within milliseconds of either way of being good or bad. Now,
that's the new thing, right? It's that they have the cameras and they go back and view, and that's why the penalties take a couple laps to get out, because by this time, Aleix Espargaró was already out on lap two before the penalties came through. And it was just like Crutchlow's, where it came and it was a little bit of movement forward, and you're thinking, man, we're going to have this big debate again, and Vinales is going to be pissed. And he took the wrong penalty, went around the lap. But what I found interesting is at the end of the race, or maybe a day later, they asked him, like, you know, do you think things should change? He goes, no, I don't think anything should change. The rules are very clear. You move, it's over. He goes, I didn't intend to move. I was clutch in, but the motor got too hot and started to catch the clutch, and I think the bike started to roll. It's like, okay. But that's where I throw in the butt, Jim, because apparently, you know, last time I had a strong-ish take on it, which I caught a good amount of emails about, but where it's if this is the mechanical thing, like he said, they got to improve the clutch. Where, I think you had a nice say about it, like, where is that judgment? If does it really make an advantage? Because it can give an advantage to the point where you are going to, the penalty is so severe for maybe such a small advantage, right?
Correct. This is where you're going to wind up getting into a serious gray area, is how much movement is too much movement? Because I think everyone would agree that these motors are going to get hot. You're going to get some clutch slippage. The bike is going to creep, which we don't want that to happen, but hey, it can happen. We've seen it numerous times already. Well, to me, if the bike's creeping, and you can kind of tell that the guy is, you look at Vinales, you can kind of see his boots and his toes kind of go up like he's trying to dig his heels in, and then the light goes green, he just goes with it. So if you look at that, to me, that is take the long lap penalty. If you're blatantly over the line before the light goes, then I think that's a ride-through penalty in the pits. But that's, again, that's a very subjective area, and it started to be, they're going to have to look at it. They've got to figure something else out.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to be the guy who's going to figure that out. I just don't want this to affect the racing that I'm going to see.
Right. Because if this is something that's a continuing topic, it's not something they want to happen. If this was the last time we talk about it this year, the rule is going to stay the same. If me and you are droning on about this by the time Mugello comes up on the calendar, something has to be changed. You're going to have to start using judgment of racers, a committee rule. I don't know. It gets much tougher. But like you said, I don't want to be the person that has to figure that out. And that's why I don't want to keep talking about it, because we're going to get on to some cool stuff.
Right. So one real quick thing about this, there's the idea of the long lap, which was fine. And what Vinales did, and he thought that was the correct thing for the penalty that he received.
Twice.
But one thing I thought was interesting was the warm-up lap for MotoGP. One person rode through the long lap part of the course.
Really? Who did that?
It was only Marc Marquez.
Huh.
He was the only one who went there all weekend. All weekend. I was not in those turns all weekend, but while I was there, the only person I ever saw go through the long line as if to know how much power or throttle or what it felt like out there was Marc Marquez. He was the only one.
I mean, that shows the level this guy's thinking at, right? The preparation. He's thinking to himself, oh, if I get a penalty, I know what this feels like out here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you would say this is the mind of a champion. I mean, this is redundancy. We know it is. This guy, mm-hmm. This guy is amazing. And that's that kind of thinking where it's crossing off every single box and then some. So, not surprised he does it, too. So we get going in the race here. You know who was looking really good and out of shape in every single braking point on the track? Cal Crutchlow. He was fast, but he looked out of shape. Legs off, bumps, and away he went, unfortunately.
Yes, he went down.
Yeah, it was kind of expected. I was a little concerned. He was keeping up, but Cal was at 105% for the time that he was in the race.
You really think that?
Yeah, I think he was, because he looked... I was watching the race, and everybody else coming, they would break in formation, and you would see Cal's legs, arms moving around. Like, he's on it. I don't know if it's the bumps, the way his bike was set up. He looked, I wouldn't say out of control. These guys are in control when they're out of control, but it looked like he was on an edge. Not his edge, but the bike and the track. Something didn't look right. And then, sure enough, he went down in a breaking point. It was kind of like, all right, that looked like that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And that's right when I thought to myself, this is not good for the other people who are on a Honda.
Yeah, so, it's a good point.
Because it was one of these things that it's, Marquez is out front, and he's about 3.5 seconds up the road. Crutchlow, as you said, was on an edge. He falls, and I'm going, this is too easy. This is too easy for Marquez this time. And I just had that weird gut feeling in my pit of my stomach. And two laps later, Marquez falls off going into turn 12. Now, you would not have believed the roar that came from all the Rossi people.
Oh, you could hear it. You could hear it in the cameras.
I didn't know if you could hear it on the cameras or not, but it was insane sitting in there.
You heard it before and you got to see it on camera, actually. You heard the roars and why are people roaring? And then they cut and there's Marquez trying to pick up his bike, and then he has a bit of a, what is the...
Keystone Cops moment?
Well, Keystone Cops, so what's the music? The Benny Hill. Oh, yeah. There was a bit of Benny Hill in that one, so that wasn't his shining moment.
It was not pretty. I tell you this, after for me, I'm sitting there. Marquez is on the ground. He gets the bike up. Rossi, Miller, Rins, Dovizioso had kind of gone by. And I thought, okay, this kid's going to bump start this bike, and he's going to go chase
That's
all these people back down
too.
And win it again.
I was like, ooh, excitement.
That was, I mean, because it's Marc Marquez. Yeah. Your expectation of this kid is the impossible.
Yep.
Well, okay, he's going to do the impossible and win 7 races in a row, but he's got to do it in Marc Marquez style.
Exactly.
So I'm going to crash first and then win the race just to prove that I could do it, right? And it was in your mind for that fleeting second, and then they couldn't get the bike to start, which leads credence to people saying that Honda was having a gearbox issue. The other thing I thought that was interesting with the Marquez crash, from the onboard, it appeared as though if it was Marc Marquez pre-shoulder surgery, Marc Marquez would have saved that. But because we're Marc Marquez post-shoulder surgery, he didn't even try. The bike was gone. He folded his arm underneath of him and then fell. You know, and that's, I don't know if he could have saved it if he was 100% healthy, okay? I don't know. I'm not on the motorcycle, but it just, from the onboard, it looked like he was falling to protect that shoulder as opposed to using his elbow and shoulder to right the ship of what was wrong.
I mean, it's possible. Tough to tell. That is also the hardest braking area in the calendar, so if there was going to be a mistake on the brakes, it will be in that turn.
He's going to be there.
Yep. This is also, we saw his teammate go out. Lorenzo had we talked about that earlier in the show with electrical issues, apparently. But that left it now, because the race was a snoozer, right? That's not even trying to admit. Like, the race was a snoozer up to this point. He goes down, it's like, oh, we've got a race now. We've got Rossi and Rins. Now, I know that's not our usual combination of what's going on. But Alex Rins sitting behind Rossi looked really good. And then he made one of the best passes I've ever seen at that track to slide up at him and get
past.
He
made a Rossi move.
Yes, he did.
He made a Rossi move on Rossi. And by that, I mean he attacked Rossi at a place where Rossi was not expected to be attacked.
Not at all.
Which he did that at, let's see, 6 is the end of the S's, and you go to 7, and it's 8, and then you're leading 9 to 10. He did it going into 8. Which is a ballsy place to pass.
Just slipped on by, too, and made it look like that was what you're supposed to do. Not out of control, not sliding, not the foot off, just, oh, here I am. Then he gets out front and starts to pull a little bit away, but as about the last half lap came, Rossi, being Rossi, started closing down, looked like he was going to catch him, and they shot to David Abbrivio in the pits, and his hands were just folded onto his face. He's like, I can't believe it. Is he going to get my guy? Nope. Rins had just enough to pull through to grab his first win ever in the MotoGP race and grab Suzuki's first race, which we go back to what I was saying in the Moto3. It's a bit of an ominous comment. Since 2016, when Maverick Viñales won it at Silverstone on that nice cloudy day, which set up perfectly. But Alex Rins, man, this guy and this bike are for real this year. It looks good.
Yes, yes, they are. They are for real. And it goes to prove that an inline 4 bike is a sweet handling chassis, which is what you need over all the bumps at COTA. The interesting thing was all the time that Rins made was through the S's, which is Sector 2.
Mm-hmm.
He would put big time on Rossi.
Mm-hmm.
And it took Rossi all of the run to turn 10, which I think that's the second or the third split, and then all that running back down the back straightaway was all Rossi. The third sector Rossi owned, so Rossi would make up everything in the third sector that Rins was putting on him in the second sector, but the first sector and the first sector was even, and the fourth sector was even because we were looking at the split time. But it was an impressive ride by Rins. After the race, we were sitting there waiting for the Moto A race, and a lot of people were going, ha ha, you know, bad day for Honda because I've got my HRC gear on, my Marquez hat. And I looked at them, I'm like, why? And they all looked at me kind of funny. And I said, I'm a Marquez fan, but beyond all things, I want to see a great race. And that's what I got to see.
Yep.
So I'm happy.
You know, it was good.
Which is what it was.
It was definitely a race that was not expected at COTA, which is nice to see. Here's something, though, I noticed. We've known that the Suzuki, obviously, when they came back, they had to catch up to the horsepower. I watched Rins either hold his own or outpace Rossi on the Yamaha down that backstraight. If there's going to be a test, I mean, that's almost as long as the Aragon straight. If there's going to be a test,
it's actually longer.
Yeah, if there's going to be a test at top end, that's it. And Rossi could not reel him in. Now, I don't know if that's because the top end, they were matched equally, or if we go back to what Yamaha keeps struggling with, getting out of the corner and getting the power to the ground when they're coming off the side of the tire, if that's still the issue, right? But the Suzuki has caught up there. If it wasn't for Honda Ducati, they might be up there, but they're miles ahead at this point. But yeah, that was something I did notice, that Suzuki is at least caught Yamaha when it comes to engine performance. And Yamaha is looking really, really bad for that right now. Just because they were ahead. They were miles ahead of them, and they let them catch up. And Ducati has stayed out front. Honda has passed them and has almost caught up, if not on par with Ducati's speed. Yamaha is right where they're at. Some, I would say, back to 2017, and Suzuki's caught up on power already. So that just kind of shows you where Yamaha's at. And this alludes back to what you had talked about last year. Like, is this, which you talked about before Matt Oxley did, mind you, so I think he listens to the podcast, is that engine design done? Have they maxed that potential out? Are we there with that engine?
Mm-hmm. If you look at it from the same point as Suzuki, no. We don't need a V4 to go fast. We can do it with an inline. So, you know, okay, racing is all about compromise. It's about making the best of what you have. And if you have an inline four, you have a very compact motor, i.e., you know, your distance from the crankshaft to the end of the motor where the clutch is very, very small, very compact. In a V, you've got that, it's going to be bigger. So that means you might get more horsepower out of a V configuration, but you're going to sacrifice a little bit of the handling because you have a longer wheelbase or a longer chassis, or you have to make a different rake or trail combination off the front forks than you do if you've got that motor. So it's all playing into it. And Suzuki has gone through an evolution with the bike. They had got the handling down. It's very good. They were lacking a little bit of horsepower, so they took some crank weight off, did some modifications. That was bad. They took too much off. It was spun too quickly. They put a little bit of weight back on, and now it seems to be like they're in their butter zone, and they just need to kind of keep tweaking. I wouldn't be surprised to see Rins win at Assen. I totally think he could win there. I think he might even be in with a shout at like Le Mans to win. The cool part is here, we've got four brands that are going to win races. That is what's going to happen. Because I'm telling you people, this is not the only time Rins is going to win a MotoGP race this year. He will win more than the one that he has right now.
Yes.
Guaranteed.
Yep, I'm agreeing with that. So that leads us nicely into the race results. We had Alex Rins obviously in first, Rossi in second, and Jack Miller getting back on the podium third. You know, kind of the, you know, we didn't really talk about Miller, but Miller had a hell of a race. He was there in the battle and then, you know, slipped back and managed his tires there, bring it home third on the podium. It's good to see Jack up there. This kind of is winning my bet over Derek right now, because I thought Jack would be better than Petrucci, and Derek thought the other way. So we'll see how that goes the rest of the season. Dovizioso there in fourth. He had a nice comeback from 13th on the grid. Franco Morbidelli with his best finish in GP on there in fifth. Daniel Petrucci in sixth. Fabio Quartararo, who is now leading the Rookies Championship there in seventh. Pol Espargaró in eighth. That's a great result for the KTM. It's another top 10. Pecco Bagnaia there in ninth, who we didn't even see, I don't think, on cameras once this weekend, but got another top 10. So that's good for the rookie. And Taka Nakagami rounding out the top eight. And the Maverick, who we mentioned before, he did a nice job crawling back up to 11th. But at this point, we're kind of tied on Maverick watch. I think the Yamaha and Maverick Vinales relationship might be coming to a bitter end, unfortunately, Jim. It's like it's not the right mix. The Yamaha is.
Do you think there's a homecoming? Do you think there's a homecoming
for
Vinales at Suzuki?
You know what? I'm gonna throw this one out to you. I don't think so. Here's my prediction, and this is wild, out my ass prediction. Okay, that Vinales is gonna keep having his struggles on the Yamaha.
And I think you're right.
And Petrucci is not the guy for a Ducati factory seat. I said that at the beginning of the year. And he's going to be a top 10 guy. And he's the reason why he's had 3 sixth places in a row is because unless it rains, that's where he's going to be. And Maverick is going to wind up on a Ducati.
If he winds up on a Ducati, it's going to be on a Pramac Ducati because Miller's going to have the factory seat.
We'll see. We'll see. That is my wild hair ass prediction for like 2020 right now. But we get to the championship, and because of his damage limitation, and because Mark Marquez had a little bit of a whoopsie doodle, Andre Dovizioso right there, number one in the championship, 3 points in front of Valentino Rossi, the guy that never goes away no matter how old he gets. Alex Rins with his win, it brings him up to third in the championship. Mark Marquez, because of his fall, brings him back down to fourth in the championship. Daniel Petrucci, 6-3 races, but fifth in the championship. Jack Miller, with his performance there, getting on the podium, brings him up to sixth. Taka Nakagami, kind of nicely steady there in seventh. Kyle Crutchlow had that crash, dropped him down into eighth. Paul Espargaro in ninth. And Fabio Quartararo, the rookie, who is currently beating his teammate, who has a couple years of GP experience on him there, in tenth. Just behind him, though, 1 point, is Franco Morbidelli. And then, of course, the lonely Maverick Viñales, who is the last place of all the Yamahas on the grid. We did not expect that coming into the third round of the year. They're in 12th. So, Jim, we are three races in, and we've already got this much to talk about. This season has a long way to go.
Yeah, it's been three very good races. Three very, very good races, all for different reasons.
Damn it, you beat me to the line. Damn it, I want to be
I got the whole shot on you there, man. I got that whole shot device here on my microphone, and I'm able to just jump right in there.
So, all right, everybody. So, you know how we're breaking down the show into multiple phases? My God, there's still a lot to record about. Me and Derek need to talk about World Superbike. There was a lot from Aston to cover. What was there a lot to cover? Bautista, that's really all we need to talk about. Anyway, there's Moto America to cover, but the nice thing is we do get a couple of weeks of relief. Everybody decided to cram everything into one weekend, and now we get a weekend off, maybe because of the Easter holiday. I don't know. But anyway, we're going to have a nice little break, so probably next week we'll do some catch-up shows. I think me and Derek will record maybe a little bit later this week and throw up the World Superbike chat. I don't know. So things are going to happen. Anyway, don't forget, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. We have a Facebook page. That's facebook.com/motopod. Get over there, like us. I usually post up questions. That's probably where we're most active. We're also active on Twitter. That's @moto_pod. You can follow us there for news. All the hosts are on Twitter. For instance, you can find me at SkylarV28. That's also my name on Instagram. Jim, where can people find you?
At MotoRGV, Instagram and Twitter.
Excellent. And of course, our other host, Derek, at MotoDerekC in both Instagram and Twitter. Andrew, who we just heard for the first time this year when him and Dave did a fantastic job with the BSB preview. I'm so jealous of how those guys have their banter together. That's at Andy_Course. And of course, Dave Neal is on Twitter at Dave Neal and Instagram at The Dave Neal. Well, Jim, it was good to catch up back. We've been bouncing around with this crazy show and schedules and whatnot, but I'm glad we got to talk about some racing, and I'm also glad we get a few weeks to kind of soak everything in and get ready for the European swing.
I agree.
So, all right, folks, until next time, I'm Skyler. That's Jim. Zoom, zoom.